The Bureau had presented Congress with a fait accompli in the form of a gigantic foundation designed to support a gravity dam 550 feet tall. To build a 200-foot dam on it would have been like mounting a Honda body on the chassis of a truck. Phil Nalder, who rose from draftsman to manager of the entire Columbia Basin project, was as circumspect as Weil about the Bureau's motives and strategy. According to Nalder, the Bureau determined belatedly that a low dam would have been impractical at the site. But that, of course, is something the Bureau must have recognized all along. There was nothing impractical about building a low dam for power navigation, but building a low dam for an irrigation project was hopelessly impractical. Nalder, at least, was a bit more candid about whether the evidence didn't suggest that Roosevelt and the Bureau had pulled a fast one on the Congress. "Well, if you look at the evidence superficially," he said, "it would certainly appear that way." The issue of a high dam versus a low dam involved much more than power production and the fate of the irrigation project. It also involved the fate of the greatest spawning run of salmon in the world. During the Depression, salmon was the one high-protein food most people could afford. It was still so abundant that it cost about 10 cents for a one-pound can. America's Atlantic salmon were almost wiped out by then. Virtually all domestic salmon came from Alaska and the West Coast, and the greatest run, equal to or greater than all the streams and rivers in Oregon and California combined, went up the Columbia River. Some of the fish branched off into the lower tributaries to spawn, but the majority went far up the river into the higher tributaries, beyond Grand Coulee. Many salmon could probably have gotten past a low dam. Today, tens of thousands managed to circumnavigate the Dalles, John Day, and Bonneville dams through fish ladders every year. A high Grand Coulee dam, however, would block their passage forever. A 50-story wall rising straight out of the river would form an ultimate obstruction, hopeless and forbidding. A fish ladder, built at a proper gradient, would have to run for many miles, cut into sheer canyon walls. No one was even talking about building it. The cost might approach the price of the dam. Fish facilities at Bonneville Dam's second power plant, built many years later, would end up costing $65 million, almost one-fourth the cost of the power plant itself. If the high dam spelled doom for most of the salmon in the Columbia River, however, it did perform a miraculous service which, at the time, was utterly unforeseen. It probably won the Second World War. It is hard to imagine today, when big public works projects such as New York's Westway are held up for 15 years in the courts, what the go-go years were like. In 1936, the four largest concrete dams ever built, Hoover, Shasta, Bonneville, and Grand Coulee, were being erected at breakneck speed, all at the same time. In Montana, Fort Peck Dam, the largest structure anywhere except for the Great Wall, which took a third of the Chinese male population 1,000 years to build, was going up too. The age of dams reached its apogee in the 1950s and 1960s, when hundreds upon hundreds of them were thrown up, forever altering the face of the continent, but most of those dams were middle-sized, squat, utilitarian, banal. The 1930s were the glory days. No dam after Hoover has ever quite matched its grace and glorious detail. Shasta Dam looks run down now. The Grecian pavilions are rotting, the face is water-stained, but it was nearly as majestic as Hoover when it was built, and quite a bit bigger. Symbolic achievements matter terribly in the 30s, and the federal dams going up on the western rivers were the reigning symbols of the era. A few years earlier, it had been the great skyscrapers that served as the landmarks of American achievement. In the late 1920s, they were rising simultaneously, too. The Empire State Building, the Chrysler Building, the Bank of Manhattan, 70 Pine Street, the Lincoln-Levesque Tower in Columbus, and the Carew Tower in Cincinnati. But just as they were being finished, the capitalist engine that had built them fell into ruin. In a slip of time, the mantle of achievement passed from private enterprise to public works. The dams announced that America could still do remarkable things. They also said that the country would never be the same. The centralized welfare state that everyone decries, and nearly everyone depends on to some degree, is said to have emerged from the war, the Depression, and the Great Society. It might be more accurate to say that it was born in the rivers of the American West. Hoover was big. Shasta was half again as big. Grand Coulee was bigger than both together. Many of the workers who came up to build it were those who had just finished Hoover. When they imagined it filling this huge U-shaped canyon, they were speechless. When they worked on Hoover, they thought it made everything else look like nothing, says Phil Nalder. When they saw what we were going to build here, they said it made Hoover look like nothing. After a while, visitors being taken around the dam site became tired of the phrase largest in the world. The mass, 10.5 million cubic yards, and crest length, 4/5 of a mile, were, for a concrete dam, the largest and longest in the world. The concrete mixing plant, the spillway, the generators, the powerhouse, the pumps, the penstocks, and the pump lift from the reservoir to the irrigated benchlands would all be the largest in the world. And as the dam went up, the engineers were still scratching their heads about how to lift such an immense volume of water 30 stories high. The turbines, the scroll casings, the conveyor belts, the forms, the cofferdams, and the concentration of brothels and bars within a 5-mile radius were also the largest in the world. The dam's dimensions, height and length, were roughly those of the Golden Gate Bridge. It was not quite as high or long, but it was solid, and at the base 5 times as wide. Grand Coulee would use more lumber, 130 million board feet, than any edifice ever built, but it was a tiny fraction of the dam's total mass, and none of it was even visible. Like Hoover, the dam was so massive it would ordinarily have required hundreds of years to cool down, and cooling pipe had to be laid through it at close intervals. Laid out in a straight line, the pipe would have connected Seattle to Chicago. The astonishing thing about Grand Coulee, about the whole era, was that people just went out and built it, built anything, without knowing exactly how to do it or whether it could even be done. There were no task forces, no special commissions, no proposed possible preliminary outlines of conceivable tentative recommendations. Tremendous environmental impacts, but no environmental impact statements. When Chuck Weil applied for a job on Grand Coulee, he didn't know the first thing about concrete. Before long, he was inspecting more concrete than anyone in history. Phil Nalder was trained as an electrical engineer. He started as a tracer, one rung below draftsman, and later on was put in charge of the whole project. Once, well into construction, a mudslide the size of a small mountain came off one side of the canyon and threatened to cover the foundation of the dam. To stabilize it, the Bureau ran around the northwest looking for the biggest refrigeration units it could find. Then it ran supercooled brine through the slide and froze it while construction continued. No one had ever tried it before, but it worked. When one of the cofferdams sprang a huge leak, it was plugged with old mattresses. The dam was finished and in service by September of 1941, an unbelievable sight. The three largest ocean liners in the world could have sat atop its crest like bathtub toys. Much of the country thought Grand Coulee was marvelous, but it was so gigantic a project that it had to invite some kind of attack. Private utilities, not quite brave enough to lambast so popular a creation, were suspected of bribing journalists to write diatribes against it. One writer, Walter Davenport, went out to see the dam for Collier's magazine. It was, he reported, in the middle of a dead land, bitter with alkali, shunned even by snakes and lizards, where the air you breathe is full of the dust of dead men's bones. But Ickes and Mike Strauss cooked up the idea of hiring Woody Guthrie as a research assistant to write some songs in praise of the dams. Guthrie, an itinerant Okie guitar picker, toured the Northwest like a prince in a chauffeured car, composing paeans to water and power like Talking Columbia. You just watch this river, and pretty soon everybody's going to be changing their tune. That Big Crane Coulee and Bonneville Dam will build 1,000 factories for Uncle Sam. And everybody else in the world making everything from sewing machines to atomic bedrooms and plastic, everything's going to be made out of plastic. Uncle Sam needs wool. Uncle Sam needs wheat. Uncle Sam needs houses and stuff to eat. Uncle Sam needs water and power dams. Uncle Sam needs people, and the people need land. Don't like dictators much myself. What I think is the whole world ought to be run by electricity. What Guthrie sensed, and what Franklin Roosevelt knew by 1939, was that America stood an excellent chance of going to war. It would be a war, won or lost, not so much through strategy as through production. Germany had the greatest industrial capacity in Europe. Japan's was the greatest in the Orient. In the balance stood the United States. And since this would be a war of, more than anything else, air power, the critical material was going to be aluminum. It would be, at least, until the critical material became plutonium. In the 19th century, aluminum had a street value close to gold's, a function of the amount of energy needed to produce it and the type of energy required. It takes 12 times as much energy to produce raw aluminum as it does to make iron, and since the process is electrolytic, it has to be done with electricity. Until another process is invented, nothing else will do. The 1,000-ounce aluminum Pope's cap installed in the pinnacle of the Washington Monument when it was completed in the mid-19th century was the largest ingot of its day. After the First World War, aluminum became cheaper, though still not common. The raw material, the production flow, the manufacturing patent, and the end uses were pretty much controlled by the Aluminum Company of America, which was to vertical integration what William Randolph Hearst was to yellow journalism. Hearst, at least, had competition. Alcoa didn't, except from Adolf Hitler, who made Germany the world leader in aluminum production soon after seizing power, for reasons the Allies did not immediately discern. When the first electricity began to flow out of Bonneville Dam, the Corps of Engineers' big power and navigation dam 300 miles downriver, the government tried to induce Alcoa's potential competitors to build plants in the Northwest by offering them bargain rates, but nobody was particularly interested. By the time the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, however, the luxury of persuasion could no longer be afforded. The government simply went out and built the plants itself. No one knows exactly how many planes and ships were manufactured with Bonneville and Grand Coulee electricity, but it is safe to say that the war would have been seriously prolonged at the least without the dams. Germany's military buildup during the 1930s gave it a huge start on Britain and France. When Hitler invaded Poland and war broke out in Europe, the United States was, militarily speaking, of no consequence. We had fewer soldiers than Henry Ford had auto workers, and not enough modern M1 Garand rifles to equip a single regiment. By 1942, however, we possessed something no other country did, a huge surplus of hydroelectric power. By June of that year, 92% of the 900,000 kilowatts of power available from Grand Coulee and Bonneville dams, an almost incomprehensible amount at the time, was going to war production, most of it to building planes. One writer, Albert Williams, estimates that more than half the planes in the American Air Forces were built with Coulee power alone. After France capitulated, England was left hanging by a thread. It was rescued by a European sky suddenly full of American planes. The Columbia River was a traffic jam of barges carrying bauxite to the smelters in Longview, Washington. By the middle of the war, almost half of the aluminum production in the country was located in the Northwest, nearly all of it going toward the war effort. American planes were being downed almost as fast as they could be produced. German planes, however, were being downed faster than they could be produced. The Nazis had neither the raw materials nor the electricity to produce what they needed fast enough. In late 1940, when Grand Coulee Dam was being completed, people had been saying that its power would go begging until the 21st century. 22 months later, all of its available power was being used, and the defense industries were screaming for more. As the first 6 generators were being installed, the next 2 units were still being manufactured and wouldn't be ready for power production for some weeks. The war was at such a critical juncture that some weeks was too long. The Bureau collected every outsized piece of transportation equipment it could find, took the 2 generators waiting to be installed at Shasta Dam, and laboriously moved them to Grand Coulee instead. Shasta's generators were 30,000 kilowatts smaller than Grand Coulee's, and the turbines revolved in the wrong direction. Grand Coulee's went clockwise. Shasta's went counterclockwise. The Bureau solved the problem by installing the Shasta units in the wrong pits and excavating tunnels to the proper ones next door so the water could surge in from the right side. After the war, the engineers had to invent some mammoth excavation devices to shoehorn them out. The Westinghouse generators built for Grand Coulee were rated for a maximum output of 105,000 kilowatts each, which was the capacity of a good-sized oil power plant that could run, say, Duluth. For the entire duration of the war, they ran at 125,000 kilowatts, 24 hours a day, without a glitch. "We would shut one down only when it was absolutely necessary," says Phil Nalder. "You'd stand there in the powerhouse and feel that low vibration, that low but incredibly powerful vibration, and you'd feel certain that they were going to burn themselves up. And you'd think that maybe the course of history depended on these damn things. But they never overheated, so we just ran them and ran them. God knows they were beautifully made." By the end of the war, at Grand Coulee, we were generating 2,138,000 kilowatts of electricity. We were the biggest single source of electricity in the world. The Germans and the Japanese didn't have anything nearly that big. Imagine what it would have been like without Grand Coulee, Hoover, Shasta, and Bonneville. At the time, they were ranked 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th in the world. We had so much power at Grand Coulee that we could afford to use 2 generators just to run Hanford. Although few of the people who lived there knew it at the time, the strange, squat structures going up in 1943 at the Hanford Reservation, an ultra-secret military installation along the Columbia River near Richland, Washington, were intimately connected to the Manhattan Project. A lot of the history is well known now, how Niels Bohr were smuggled out of Nazi-occupied Denmark in the wheel well of a British balsa wood aircraft, how pacifistic Albert Einstein urged Franklin Roosevelt to build the bomb before the Nazis did, how thousands of technicians and scientists descended on the tiny mountain hamlet of Los Alamos, New Mexico, to figure out how to build their catastrophically explosive device. The key material was plutonium-239, an element virtually unknown in nature which has just the right fissile characteristics for an atomic bomb. Problem with plutonium, aside from its being fiendishly toxic, is that its production is energy consumptive in the extreme. The amount of electricity used by the 8 plutonium production reactors at Hanford is still classified information, but a good guess is 15 or 20 megawatts each, perhaps 160 megawatts in all. Nowhere else in a country involved in a gigantic war effort could one have found that kind of power to spare. In the end, the Axis powers were no match for 2 things: the Russian winters and an American hydroelectric capacity that could turn out 60,000 aircraft in 4 years. We didn't so much outmaneuver, outman, or outfight the Axis as simply outproduce it. The main stem of the Columbia River didn't have a single dam on it until 1933, when the Puget Sound Power and Light Company went out on its own and built a run-of-the-river dam called Rock Island, which produced 212,000 kilowatts of power, a mind-boggling amount in its day. 5 years later, Bonneville Dam was finished and generated almost 3 times as much power. In 1941 came Grand Coulee, in 1953, McNary Dam, in 1955, Chief Joseph Dam, in 1957, the Dalles, contributing 1,807,000 kilowatts to the 7 million or so that had already been wrung out of the river. In that same year, the Grant County Public Utility District finished Priest Rapids Dam, which added another 788,500 kilowatts. In 1961, the Chelan County PUD came back and built Rocky Reach Dam, with a capacity 1 million kilowatts greater than the dam by which it had gotten things off to a start 28 years before. And it still wasn't over. In 1963, the Grant County PUD added Wanapum Dam and another 831,250 kilowatts. In 1967, the Douglas County PUD completed Wells Dam. The Corps of Engineers, which had built Bonneville and Chief Joseph and McNary and the Dalles, got back into the picture in 1968 with John Day Dam, whose 2,160,000 kilowatts were second only to Grand Coulee. In that year, the Canadians finally joined in, building Keenly Side Dam, whose sole purpose was to equalize the upper river's flow throughout the year for the benefit of navigation and power production. In 1973, they added Micah Dam, which formed the largest reservoir on the river in a remote wilderness not far from the Columbia's headwaters. 13 tremendous dams in 40 years. And these were just the main stem dams. As they were going up, the Columbia tributaries were also being chinked full of dams. Libby Dam on the Kootenay River, Albany Falls and Boundary Dams on the Ponderay, Cabot at Gorge and Knox-on-Rapids Dams on the Clark Fork, Care and Hungry Horse on the Flathead, Chandler and Rosa Dams on the Yakima, Ice Harbor Dam, Lower Monumental Dam, Little Goose Dam, Lower Granite Dam, Oxbow Dam, Hell's Canyon Dam, Brownlee Dam, and Palisades Dam on the Snake, Dworshak Dam on the North Fork of the Clearwater, Anderson Ranch Dam on the South Fork of the Boise, Pelton and Round Butte Dams on the Deschutes, Big Cliff, Foster, Green Peter, and Detroit Dams on the Three Forks of the Santiam River, Cougar Dam on the South Fork of the Mackenzie, Dexter, Lookout Point, and Hills Creek Dams on the Willamette, Merwin Dam, Yale Dam, and Swift Dam on the Lewis River, Layfield and Mossy Rock Dams on the Cowlitz, 36 great dams on one river and its tributaries, a dam a year, the age of dams. The Corps of Engineers and the region's public utilities played a big role in the damming of the Pacific Northwest because it had in abundance what the rest of the region lacked, water. So many of the dams were built for flood control, navigation, or power. Everywhere else in the West, however, where deserts were the rule and irrigation was the be-all and end-all of existence, the Bureau reigned supreme. Within its first 30 years, it had built about 36 projects. During the next 30 years, it built 36 more. The Burnt River Project, the Kachuma Project, the Mancos Project, the Ogden River Project, the Colbrand Project, the Gila Project, the Pine River Project, the Palisades Project, the Weber Basin Project, the Columbia Basin Project, and the Central Valley Project. Shasta Dam, Parker Dam, Freant Dam, Davis Dam, Laguna Dam, Canyon Ferry Dam, Cascade Dam, Flaming Gorge Dam, Cedar Bluff Lake, Peonia Reservoir, Kerwin Reservoir, Webster Reservoir, Pathfinder Reservoir, Wakanda Lake, Clare Engel Lake, Lake Berryessa, Lake C.W. McConaughey, Enders Reservoir, Box Butte Reservoir, the Kachuma Project, the Palo Verde Project, the San Angelo Project, the Canadian River Project, the Crooked River Project, the Kendrick Project, the Hubbard Project, the Hiram Project, the Eden Project, the W.C. Austin Project, the Colorado Big Thompson Project, the Pecos River Basin Water Conservation Project, conservation meaning, in this case, the virtual drying up of the Pecos River, the Mercedes Division, the Middle Rio Grande Project, Trinity Dam, Keswick Dam, Folsom Dam, Morro Point Dam, Blue Mesa Dam, the Oroville-Tenasket Unit of the Okanagan-Similkameen Division of the Columbia Basin Project, Glen Canyon Dam, Lake Powell, Jewel of the Colorado. By 1956, the Congress had voted 110 separate authorizations for the Bureau of Reclamation, some encompassing a dozen or more irrigation projects and dams. Of these, 77, nearly three-quarters, were authorized between 1928 and 1956, along with hundreds of projects built by the Corps of Engineers in the East and West. In that astonishingly brief 28-year period, between the first preparations for Hoover Dam and the passage of the Colorado River Storage Project Act, the most fateful transformation that has ever been visited on any landscape, anywhere, was wrought. It was profound change, profound and permanent. You can levee a river, dredge it, riprap it, channelize it, straighten it, do almost anything to it except build a dam on it, and unless you maintain your works diligently, nature will soon take the river back. Simple diversion works of great ancient civilizations collapsed not long after the civilizations themselves did. For the most part, a remnant here and there is all that remains. Had the Assyrians built Grand Coulee Dam, however, it would sit exactly where it does today, looking exactly as it did when it was built. The only thing different is that the dam would no longer function as a dam. It would be a waterfall. The reservoir behind it would have long since silted up. And the effect would go far beyond the natural world. In the Northwest, the dams produced so much cheap hydroelectricity that hundreds of thousands of people who flocked to the region during and after the war did not bother to insulate their homes. Insulation was expensive. Electricity was dirt cheap. In 1974, $196.01 worth of power from Con Edison in New York would have cost $24 if purchased from Seattle City Light. For decades, the Northwest and British Columbia have had the highest rates of electricity consumption in the world. The result was that by the 1970s, to everyone's amazement, the seemingly limitless hydroelectric bonanza was coming to an end. Brownouts were being predicted for the 1980s. Since the good dam sites were gone, the region's utilities and their federal power broker, the Bonneville Power Administration, another product of the go-go years, launched a program of coal and nuclear power plant construction which, viewed in retrospect, seems more like dementia than the rational, orderly planning was purported to be. Of the 24,000 megawatt plants that were to be built under the Washington Public Power Supply System, one a year, five were begun, only to be scrapped or mothballed, half-completed, a few years later, threatening to cause the biggest municipal bond default in history. The cost of their construction, driven by inflation and hyperactive interest rates, drove electricity rates up, which immediately drove demand down, which drove rates further up, which drove demand further down. A self-perpetuating vortex known among municipal bond traders and their hapless victims and the region's hollow-eyed utilities as death spiral. No one knows where this fiasco, now referred to simply by the power consortium's onomatopoetic acronym WPPSS, may end. But more than $6 billion has been invested in nuclear plants that may never produce a watt of power. The blame for it, if it is worth laying blame at all, has to fall on the region's 40-year love affair with dams. It was, of course, a love affair not limited to the Northwest or even the West. The whole country wanted more dams. In Appalachia, the Tennessee Valley Authority had an answer to poverty: dams. No river in the entire world has as much of its course under reservoirs as the Tennessee. By the late 1960s, it was hard to find a 10-mile free-flowing stretch between dams. The Missouri is a close second. About 700 miles in its middle reaches become a series of gigantic stair-step reservoirs. In Texas and Oklahoma, between 1940 and 1975, something like 8 million acres of land were submerged by artificial lakes. Much of this land was in the eastern part of those states. It was exceptionally fertile, as were the bottomlands along the Tennessee, and visited by adequate rainfall, making it some of the best farmland in the nation. No one seemed bothered by the spectacle of a government creating expensive farmland out of deserts in the west, while drowning millions of acres of perfect farmland in the east. If there was a stretch of free-flowing river anywhere in the country, our reflex action was to erect a dam in its path. There were legitimate reasons, of course, to build a fair number of those thousands of dams. Hydropower, obviously, was one. The Columbia dams helped prevent the horror of Nazism from blackening the entire world. Some new irrigation projects made economic sense. As late as the 1940s and 1950s, though virtually none did after then. The Tennessee and Red Rivers were prone to destructive floods, as was the Columbia, as were many rivers throughout the country. A better solution, in many cases, would have been to discourage development in floodplains, but the country, least of all the Congress, wasn't interested in that. For a dam, whether or not it made particularly good sense, whether or not it decimated a salmon fishery or drowned a gorgeous stretch of wild river, was a bonanza to the constituents of the congressmen in whose district it was located, especially the engineering and construction firms that became largely dependent on the government for work. The whole business was like a pyramid scheme. The many, the taxpayers, were paying to enrich the few, but most members of Congress figured that if they voted for everyone else's dams, someday they would get a dam too. And this, as much as the economic folly and the environmental damage, was the legacy of the go-go years, the corruption of national politics. Water projects came to epitomize the pork barrel. They were the oil can that lubricated the nation's legislative machinery. Important legislation, an education bill, a foreign aid bill, a conservation bill, was imprisoned until the president agreed to let a powerful committee chairman tack on a rider authorizing his pet dam. Franklin Roosevelt had rammed a lot of his public works programs through a Congress that was, if not resistant, then at least recumbent. A generation or two later, however, it was Congress that was writing omnibus public works bills, authorizing as much as $20 billion worth of water projects at a stroke and defying threats of presidential vetoes. Most members who voted for such bills had not the faintest idea what was in them. They didn't care. They didn't dare look. All that mattered was that there was something in it for them. What had begun as an emergency program to put the country back to work, to restore its sense of self-worth, to settle the refugees of the Dust Bowl, grew into a nature-wrecking, money-eating monster that our leaders lacked the courage or ability to stop. Chapter 6. Rivals in Crime. On the 16th of August, 1962, Major General William F. Cassidy, the Director of Civil Works for the United States Army Corps of Engineers, gave a speech titled, "The Future of Water Development," before a gathering of his peers in Davis, California. Considering what Cassidy had to say, the speech attracted surprisingly little attention in the press. "Before white men came to North America," the general began, "it is estimated that about 1 million Indians inhabited the region between the Canadian border and the Gulf of Mexico. The streams were unpolluted, the forests still stood, and the plow had not broken the plains. They had the resources of a continent at their disposal, and about 400 acres of arable land for every man, woman, and child. Yet they often starved, because they lacked the capacity to develop their resources." "In the 1890s, Cassidy continued, "the United States had about 77 acres of cultivated land per person. Before World War I, about 4 acres. Today, we have only about 2 acres of cultivated land per person. Yet the United States maintains the highest level of living known to history. It exports food to other nations, and it has even accumulated substantial surpluses of a few crops. This is the result of increasingly intensive resource development." But all of this resource development had been a mere warm-up exercise compared with what was still to come. "During the next 20 years, Cassidy went on, "we estimate that we will have to provide some 320 million acre-feet of reservoir storage at a cost of about $15 billion. about 13,000 miles of new or improved inland waterways, about 60 new or improved commercial harbors, 30 million kilowatts of hydroelectric power generating capacity, some 11,000 miles of levees, flood walls, and channel improvements, and recreational facilities for perhaps 300 million visitors at our reservoirs. If all of that seemed unduly large or visionary, Cassidy admonished, let us remember the responsibilities our nation is facing. It is worth taking a moment to put some of these figures in perspective. In 1962, the total amount of federally built reservoir storage in the nation was somewhere around 300 million acre feet. In 20 years, Cassidy wanted to more than double that. Every year, the Mississippi River carries about 355 million acre feet of water out to sea. The runoff of most of the United States from Pennsylvania to Montana. In 20 years, according to the Corps of Engineers, we were going to put the equivalent of 90% of that water behind dams. In 1962, there were 37,342 megawatts of installed hydroelectric generating capacity in the United States. By 1982, that figure was nearly to double. By 1962, nearly all the major rivers in the United States, long reaches of the Mississippi, the Snake, the Columbia, the Illinois, the Missouri, the Sacramento, the Susquehanna, the Red, the Delaware, the Tennessee, the Apalachicola, the Savannah, had been dredged, realigned, straitjacketed, riprapped, diked, levied, stabilized, and otherwise made over in order to accommodate barge and freighter traffic. In 20 years, we were going to add or improve 13,000 more miles. And this Promethean agenda was going to be possible, according to the Director of Civil Works, because we were about to enter an era of unprecedented cooperation in planning water resource development to meet future needs. The walls which formerly separated various spheres of interest are crumbling under the pressure of manifold needs. Even allowing for the temper of the times, Cassidy's prophecy, in retrospect, seems one of derangement more than vision. 19 years later, the $15 billion which was to construct 328 million acre-feet of reservoir storage would barely suffice to build 10 million acre-feet of new storage in California, had it been politically possible to do it. It was hard to imagine 13,000 miles of new or improved navigable waterways without envisioning barges bumping against the Rocky Mountains or poking into bulrushes at the headwaters of southern streams. Even had there been money to build all those reservoirs, there wasn't any room for them, as Cassidy was almost willing to admit. In many intensively occupied river basins, he said, using the military jargon of which the Corps is inordinately fond, we face a very difficult task in finding sites for the reservoirs needed to support future growth, thus raising the prospect of a nation requiring so many new dams to feed water and electricity into its hyperventilating economy that it would flood itself right off the land and find itself forced to go about its business aboard houseboats. Actually, the general's vision was to mutate into irony as fabulous as the prophecy itself. He was right in one sense. You did not build such incredible works to carry water from areas of surplus to areas of deficit without intricate political compromises among the states involved and unprecedented collaboration between the agencies that would presumably do the job, the Bureau of Reclamation and the Corps. But he was dead wrong in predicting that such harmonious relations would ever be. And if a single entity could be blamed for this, because it schemed constantly against its would-be confederate, because it seized every opportunity to build any senseless project it could, because it worked diligently, if unwittingly, to give water development a bad name, it was none other than his own agency, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. In California, where Cassidy gave his speech, at the very moment, in fact, when he was giving his speech, the Corps of Engineers was shamelessly trying to steal from the Bureau of Reclamation at least one major project the Bureau had intended to build for years. It had already done it several times before, in California and elsewhere. Across the entire West, the Corps, as opportunistic and ruthless an agency as American government has ever seen, was trying to seduce away the Bureau's irrigation constituency. It was toadying up to big corporate farmers who wanted to monopolize whole rivers for themselves. It was even prepared to defy the President of the United States. As a result, the business of water development was to become a game of chess between two ferociously competitive bureaucracies on a board that was half a continent plus Alaska, where rivers were the pawns and dams the knights and queens used to checkmate the other's ambition. But the Corps and the Bureau played a little too well and a little too long for their own good. While they were fighting over a Lake Ontario-sized reservoir in the middle of Alaska and over countless squalid little projects desired by local interest groups, an unprecedented water crisis was gathering on the southern high plains, a crisis tailor-made for their own limitless ambition, which in the end they would do nothing about. The Corps and the Bureau wasted so much money on frivolous projects which didn't so much solve the nation's water situation as satisfy the greed of powerful interests and their own petty ambitions, that in the 1980s, despite dozens of new dams and reservoirs built during the intervening years, a water crisis loomed larger than in 1962. Within the next half century, as much irrigated land is likely to go out of production, land that grows nearly 40% of our agricultural exports, as the Bureau of Reclamation managed to put into production during its entire career. And though projects to rescue those regions remain on the drawing boards, the age when they might have been built seems to have passed. The Corps of Engineers, the construction arm of the United States Army, was baptized during the Revolutionary War, when a group of engineers in the Continental Army built a breastwork on Bunker Hill. In 1794, the Corps was officially christened with its current name and divided into a civilian and a military works branch. The civil works branch, which was to become by far the larger of the two, began modestly enough, clearing driftwood and sunken ships out of rivers and harbors, and occasionally doing a bit of dredging. It also played a role in the early exploration and surveying of the nation. The Corps' great work and its transmutation into one of history's most successful bureaucracies began late in the 19th century, when it took upon itself the task of restyling America's largest rivers to accommodate barge traffic and, occasionally, deep-draft ships. At the same time, it found a role for itself in flood control, which it first accomplished by building levees and dikes, and then, after denying for years that reservoirs could control floods, by building flood-control reservoirs. And it built them at a pace that would have left the most ambitious pharaoh dazzled, something like 660 years. The Army engineers have so many hands and so many different types of work that their various activities sometimes cancel each other out. The Corps drains and channels wetlands. It has ruined more wetlands than anyone in history, except perhaps its counterpart in the Soviet Union, yet sometimes prohibits the draining and dredging of wetlands by private developers and other interests. This was a role forced on the Corps by the Congress, not one it undertook voluntarily. Its dams control flooding, while its stream channelization and wetlands drainage programs cause it. Its subsidization of intensive agriculture, which it does by turning wetlands into dry land so they may then become soybean fields, increases soil erosion, which pours into the nation's rivers, which the Corps then has to dredge more frequently. Cynics say this is all done by design, because the Corps of Engineers' motto, "Building Tomorrow Today," really ought to be "Keep Busy." Its range of activities is breathtaking. The Corps dams rivers, deepens rivers, straightens rivers, riprap rivers, builds bridges across rivers, builds huge navigation locks and dams, builds groins on rivers and beaches, builds hatcheries, builds breakwaters, builds piers, and repairs beach erosion, finally fulfilling the first stage of a destiny conservationists have long wished on it, carrying sand piles from one end of the country to the other and back again. The works for which the Corps is most famous, or notorious, depending on one's point of view, are the monumental inland navigation projects such as Red River, Tennessee Tombigbee, and Arkansas River. However, though each of these may cost billions to begin with and hundreds of millions to maintain, the opportunities for such work are pretty thin. Opportunities for serious work come most frequently in the form of flood control and water supply dams. The Corps confined its activities mainly to the East and Middle West until the Great Depression. It is widely and falsely regarded as the eastern counterpart of the Bureau of Reclamation, but the temptations of the West ultimately proved too much to resist. Throughout much of the East, it is hard to find a decent spot for a dam. There are few tight gorges and valleys, or there are few natural basins behind them, or there are too many people along rivers who would have to be moved. Not that uprooting and relocating people particularly bothers the Army engineers. It is more a matter of expense. The West, however, is a dam builder's nirvana, full of deep, narrow canyons and gunsight gaps opening into expansive basins. The West is also more sparsely populated and has floods, enormous floods, because its precipitation tends to be both erratic and highly seasonal, and because of this, the ground cover, compared with the East, is spare. With little in the way of grass or forests or wetlands to hold it back, runoff during the storms is extreme. Small streams, even tiny creeks, have flowed at rates approaching the country's largest rivers. They rarely flow like this for long, but a few minutes is all it takes to float away a town. Bijou Creek in Colorado, nearly always dry, has gone over 400,000 cubic feet per second after an 8-inch rainstorm. California's Eel River peaked at 765,000 cubic feet per second, the flow of the Mississippi and the Columbia combined during the Christmas flood of 1964. On many rivers in the West, a dam built for irrigation will incidentally control floods. But the equation also works in reverse. A flood-controlled dam, by evening out a river's flow year-round, makes it useful for irrigation. And if the Corps of Engineers builds the dam and calls it a flood-controlled dam, the water is free.
The Kings, the Kaweah, the Tule, and the Kern are the southernmost rivers flowing out of the Sierra Nevada into the Central Valley of California. They are the only rivers that do not ultimately end up in either the Sacramento or the San Joaquin drainage, because a low rise of land in the upper San Joaquin Valley, south of Fresno, effectively divides the valley into two hydrologic basins.
The southernmost one, which receives the runoff of the Kings, Kaweah, Tule, and Kern, is known as Tulare Basin. Historically, the four rivers of Tulare Basin went into two terminal lakes, Tulare and Buena Vista, which appeared and disappeared every year like phantoms. During the wet winters, the lakes would begin to fill. They would reach their largest size in May after 20 feet of Sierra snow had melted into them in a matter of weeks.
And in all but the wettest years, they would evaporate so quickly under the glaring summer sun that they were dry again, or mostly dry, around September.
Tulare,
the most impressive of the two lakes, often grew larger than Lake Tahoe, though it was not more than a few feet deep. From year to year, its shoreline would shrink or grow by miles. It was a wonderful sight to see all of that water glimmering amid the merciless dryness of the San Joaquin Valley in summer, and the lakes were a stopover for millions of migrating ducks, geese, and sandhill cranes.
Before World War II, most of the agricultural lands around Tulare and Buena Vista Lakes,
and the lakes themselves, were owned by four private landholders. They were, in a sense peculiar to California, family farms. Buena Vista Lake, and the land around it, was the largest remnant of the million-acre domain amassed by Henry Miller, and later squandered by a succession of dissolute heirs. The property encompassed about 80,000 acres, seven times the area of Manhattan Island. The adjacent Kern County Land Company, the estate originally put together by Miller's arch-enemies, James Ben Ali Hagen and Lloyd Tevis, was even larger. According to testimony by Senator Paul Douglas before the Senate Interior Committee in 1958, the company controlled some 1.1 million acres in 1939, of which 413,300 acres were in California, most of it in Kern County. the Kern County Land Company later became the main agricultural holding of the Tenneco Corporation, one of the nation's largest conglomerates. The Salyer and Boswell farming empires were in and around Tulare Lake, each of them comprising tens of thousands of acres. Since most large California growers also lease land, the total acreage under their control could only be guessed at. They may not have known themselves. Without a doubt, however, Salyer, Boswell, Kern County Land, and Miller and Lux were among the very largest and richest farmers in the entire world. To the four companies, Tulare and Buena Vista Lake were both a convenience and a nuisance. Usually, as the lakes shrank, their exposed beds would be quickly planted with grains or row crops, which were irrigated by pumping back the remaining water. After particularly wet winters, however, and there had been a string of them in the 1940s, the Sierra snowmelt kept filling them into July and August, by which time it was too late to plant. Both water and available land were therefore unpredictable, and though farmers around the world have learned to live with unpredictableness, it is something that California's big growers, accustomed as they are to perfect summer weather and unfailing man-made rain through irrigation, intensely dislike.
Although Tulare and Buena Vista lakes were privately owned,
for the most part, the rivers that fed them were in the public domain. The four biggest farming companies held rights to a substantial amount of their water, but there were still big surpluses in all but the driest years, especially in the larger rivers, the Kings and the Kern. Had those surpluses been directed elsewhere in the valley, they could have created a great many small irrigated farms. If the rivers were going to be developed, if any agency of government was to develop them, it was a job for the Bureau of Reclamation. The only problem with that rationale was that the big growers wanted all of the water for themselves. They wanted the government to develop it for them, and they didn't want to have to pay for it. Someday, if anyone has the inclination or the ability to penetrate the wall of secrecy behind which the Corps of Engineers has always managed to carry on its affairs, we may hear from its own mouth, from incriminating letters, memoranda, or confessions of its officials, why it was so eager to develop the Kings and the Kern, to ally itself unabashedly with a handful of huge land monopolies and, in the process, shove the Bureau off two made-to-order small farm irrigation projects. The only obvious explanation, which is probably the correct one, is that it sensed the growing unpopularity of the acreage limitations of the Reclamation Act. Here was an unparalleled opportunity to establish a beachhead in a region where the natural topography and demand for water could give it new work for decades to come. No stranger to power politics, the Corps knew that its best hope of long-range success was a quick, dramatic demonstration of its abilities. The best way to ensure that was to pick a group of beneficiaries who were nearly as potent a political force as the Corps itself. If this was indeed its reasoning, then it reasoned well. In 1937, the Bureau of Reclamation was just beginning its detailed feasibility investigations of the Kings and Kern River projects. It had, in fact, already been authorized to build the Kings River project on the basis of cruder reconnaissance studies alone. In the very same year that the Bureau began its investigations, however, the Corps went to the House Flood Control and Appropriations Committee and extracted an authorization and some money to perform investigations of its own on these same two rivers. Rivers, which in effect had already been promised to the Bureau. It was a brazen act. The Bureau was incensed, and Haralikes, the Interior Secretary, was apoplectic. Nonetheless, neither the Bureau nor Rickes could do anything to stop the Corps. They were, in effect, in a race. The National Resources Planning Board, one of FDR's super agencies, pleaded with the agencies to plan a unified project, then practically ordered them to do so. But they refused. As a result, in 1940, Congress received two separate reports on developing the Kings and the Kern, one on a traditional reclamation project, the other on a project that purported to be for flood control, but which, by controlling the river's runoff and drying up Tulare Lake, would irrigate a roughly equal amount of land. It was a bureaucratic battle that was to drag on for more than 5 years. Sympathies in California, where the Bureau had a lot of support from smaller farmers, were divided, as they were in Congress. The Roosevelt administration, however, was emphatically on the side of the Bureau of Reclamation. FDR felt so strongly about the matter that on the 5th of May, 1941, he wrote a personal letter to the chairman of the House Flood Control Committee saying, "A good rule for Congress to apply in considering these water projects, in my opinion, would be that the dominant interest should determine which agency should build and operate the project." Obviously, Roosevelt said, the dominant interest was irrigation. Not only that, but Kings River had already been authorized for construction by the Bureau of Reclamation. To reauthorize would only lead to needless confusion. But the Flood Control Committee was practically married to the Corps of Engineers and ignored Roosevelt's recommendation. The committee quickly authorized Kings River for construction by the Corps. With Ickes lobbying furiously on behalf of the Bureau, however, the full Congress refused to go along. At that point, FDR made what would, in retrospect, look like a fateful mistake. The United States had by then entered the Second World War to squander precious funds on a water project when there was still no demonstrable need for it seemed foolish. Even a few $100,000 would have given the Bureau enough of a head start, at least on the already authorized Kings River project, to thwart the Corps' ambition. But Roosevelt refused to recommend any money in his budget. To the Corps of Engineers, the Bureau's inability to move represented a last chance. In 1942, without any clear authorization from Congress, it began to construct an emergency flood diversion structure on the Lower Kings. Although its action outraged those members who sided with the Bureau and who saw what the Corps was trying to do, they could not bring the full Congress, now utterly preoccupied with the war, to waste its time debating such a trivial issue. Besides, the Corps' works didn't seem like much, a mere diversion gate. But it wasn't the size of the work so much as the fact that the Corps had established its beachhead in the Tulare Basin before the Bureau ever got to turn a shovel full of earth. The Corps also made sure the floodwaters were diverted where they could do some economic good, toward the lands of the big growers. Nothing much happened with the Kings River and Kern River projects during the Middle War years. By 1944, however, Europe's farmlands and economy were in ruins. Overnight, the United States had become the breadbasket of the world. Now, at last, the two projects seemed to make some sense. In his budget request for fiscal year 1945, FDR included a request of $1 million to permit the Bureau to begin work on the Kings River. The House, dominated by the Flood Control Committee, immediately took the appropriation out. The Senate threw it back in. Finally, hearings had to be scheduled to try to resolve the matter. It was at those hearings that the Corps of Engineers demonstrated where its true loyalty lay. Although the White House had left absolutely no doubt that it was strongly behind a reclamation project and expected the rest of the administration to support its position, the Corps of Engineers chose not to. Instead, Chief of Engineers Raymond A. Wheeler displayed outright defiance of his commander-in-chief. Testifying at the hearings, Wheeler gave no support at all to the Roosevelt position, a breach of loyalty that made Harold Ickes, the ultimate Roosevelt loyalist, absolutely livid. Meanwhile, the deputy chief was busy undermining the administration's position back in California. In a speech to a group of business leaders in Sacramento, Major General Thomas Robbins said that Californians were being denied necessary flood control by a lot of arguments that are neither here nor there. If the state would only wake up and get the water first and then decide what to do with it, he said, she would be a lot better off. Otherwise, by the time the dams are built, we may be all dead. What Robbins didn't say is that most Californians wouldn't be able to use the water in the Kings and the Kern if the Corps built the dams. It had already announced that it would build dams, but not aqueducts. Therefore, the water couldn't go anywhere but down the river channels, and the big growers owned nearly all the land on both sides. The Corps had also announced that if its projects offered incidental irrigation benefits, it would not apply the Reclamation Act and its acreage laws. What all of this meant was that if the Corps built the Kings and Kern dams, nearly all of the water could be used by four agribusiness giants and a handful of oil companies owning land nearby, which were to become agribusiness giants themselves. In the end, the hearings resolved nothing. Congress was still deadlocked.